courses with me. This is the Ontario Association of Physics Teachers. I want to focus, well, on relativity, but on teaching relativity, of course. Students love relativity. I love relativity. It's got really interesting things, such as time dilation, length contraction. But it can be a little tricky. There are pitfalls that students can fall into. There are pitfalls that I have fallen into in teaching relativity. So I want to focus on teaching relativity, but avoiding the pitfalls. So this is sort of the outline of what I want to kind of go through. And you'll notice it starts off with Galilean relativity. I think it's really important before students see all the weird and wonderful things for them to get a good grounding in things that they can kind of think about on a more concrete level. And then we'll move to talk about what we mean by events, because we'll often be talking about certain events with subatomic particles in special relativity. And then on to Einstein's postulates, which lead to the Lorentz-Einstein transformations, and then into the interesting stuff, the relativity of time, relativity of length, and then on to the most famous equation in all of science, E equals mc squared. And exactly what does that mean? So here's the first pitfall avoidance tip. You know, it's this little guy. This is a student falling into a pit, or worse, it could be me falling into a pit while dealing with special relativity. A good introduction to Galilean relativity is very useful before getting into the special relativity stuff. And so we're going to be talking about reference frames. We're going to have a reference frame that I'll call S. That's, let's say, the room or the surface of the Earth. And we have a coordinate system here, x, y, z. There's the origin. This is going to be fixed relative to this room for the next hour or so. So there's frame S. We'll assume that the surface of the Earth is an inertial frame. Here's another frame of reference, another inertial frame. It's moving at constant velocity in the positive x direction relative to frame S. This is frame S prime. You can see the axes x prime, y prime, z prime. And this is going to represent a number of things over the next hour, represent a muon or a bus or whatever. And so we've got these two inertial reference frames. Just for convenience, we're going to set our clock, t equals 0, to be when the origins of these frames coincide. So here's t equals 0, and then as time progresses, this frame moves along. After some time t, since this is moving at a constant velocity v, this frame will have moved a distance vt relative to the origin of that one. And now on to some of these things have fancy names. The Galilean transformation equations, which just allow us to calculate, if we know a value in one frame, say a position or velocity, allow us to calculate the corresponding value in the other frame. So here's an object, this little car. Relative to the origin of frame S, the position of that car right now is x. Relative to the origin of frame S prime, the position of the car is x prime. This drawing was made at time t, so frame S prime had already moved the distance vt away from the origin of frame S. And you can see just from the drawing, this position x is just the sum of x prime and vt. So there's the first Galilean transformation equation, x equals x prime plus vt. We can take derivatives, time derivatives of that equation. So we get here dx dt equals dx prime dt plus the derivative of vt with respect to time. Dx dt I'm going to write as u. U is the velocity of the car relative to s, the rate of change of position. Dx prime dt is u prime, the velocity of the car relative to frame s prime. And since v is a constant, when I take the derivative of vt, I just get v. So here's another Galilean transformation equation, this one for position. Oops, I went one too far. I can't read that from over there. So up at the top, we had those two transformation equations, one for position, one for velocity. And now we take another time derivative, so time derivative of a velocity is an acceleration, so that'll give us A, the acceleration of the car relative to frame S. Taking the derivative of that gives us A prime, and the derivative of this velocity, V, because it's a constant, the derivative of that with respect to time gives us a zero. So the acceleration transformation equation is a very simple one, just A equals A prime. So there we have the three Galilean transformation equations. And along with y equals y prime, z equals z prime, and t equals t prime for Galilean relativity, that's our whole set of Galilean transformation equations. So it's all sort of simple stuff, and I'm just going to go fairly quickly through some simple questions. But what these questions force the students to do is to start thinking about some simple situation in terms of frames of reference, Galilean transformation equations. And then once we get on to special relativity, where they have to continue to think about frames of reference, and the results are no longer intuitive, some of the answers to these questions will be, will have been very useful practice. So here's a question. A bus is traveling forward at 25 meters per second relative to Earth. The rear of the bus passes a bus stop. A certain time later, a woman passenger standing or sitting 5 meters from the rear of the bus stands up. How far is she from the bus stop at this time? I imagine a number of you can just work that out in your head. It's 25 meters per second for 0.8 seconds. That's 20 meters, and she was 5 meters from the back, so the answer is going to be 25 meters. And a lot of your students in grade 12 will probably do that in their heads. But what I want to do with students, this would be in first year university, say, is to get them used to thinking about frames. We need to define which frame we're going to call S and which frame S prime. So usually we think of frame S as being fixed relative to the Earth or some other object like the moon or something. So there's frame S, the Earth, frame S prime, the bus. We need to choose where the origins are going to be. And remember, for those Galilean transformation equations, we assumed that the origins coincided at time t equals zero. And we're told that the rear of the bus passes a bus stop, and then some time later, this woman stands up. So time t equals zero is going to be when the rear of the bus passed the bus stop. So there's our x equals zero position. The rear of the bus is x primed equals zero, and here's this woman standing up 5 meters away from the origin of frame S prime. And here's our vt, 20 meters. And we can just use that Galilean transformation equation to do what I imagine most of you did in your head already, 25 meters. But it forces, again, the students to think about which frame is which. And something I mentioned that was on the previous slide is the positive x direction. They always have to have frame S prime moving in the positive x direction with this constant velocity. Even without really doing any calculations, a number of questions like this are very useful for the students to think about. This woman sitting in the bus, what's her velocity relative to the Earth? That's the same as the velocity of the bus, 25 meters per second. What's the velocity relative to the bus? Zero. What's the velocity of the Earth relative to the bus? Well, it's going to be in the negative direction, so negative 25 meters per second. And during a time of 0.8 seconds, how far does the woman move relative to Earth? Well, that would be 20 meters. And how far relative to the bus? That would be zero. I want to move on to events, but as I do that, I'm thinking it's now 8:15 in this frame of reference. I was sitting there for about an hour, and you've been sitting there for about 1.25 hours now. So we're going to do something non-relativistically. Physics exercise is to get the blood flowing again for a couple minutes. I'd all like you up on your feet, please. Hands behind your back, up in your tiptoes for a count of five. Here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I want you to stand on your right leg for a count of five. I'm going to stand on my left leg for a count of five. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Very good. Everybody sit down, please. Except I'd like you and you and you to repeat those exercises with me over here, please. So I'm going to ask you to repeat the exercises, except I want your hands behind your back, and I want your toes right up against this glass wall. And I'm going to challenge you to stand up there for a count of five. Here, toes right up against the glass. Here we go. 1, 2. Seems to be a bit of a problem. They can't get up anymore. Can't get up on their feet, that is. So now I want you facing me, please. I want your right foot against the glass, and I want you to stand on your right leg for a count of five. One, two, three. Thank you very much for being such good sports. But you sort of got double the exercise, right? So what was that about? Three words? Da, 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 da. Center of mass, center of gravity. You're going to stand on your tiptoes. You've got to lean forward, get your center of mass above your tiptoes. You want to stand on one leg, you've got to get your center of mass above that one foot. It's sort of fun when you're all, like I said, stand on your right leg. Everybody kind of tilted, and then tilted back. Nothing to do with relativity. It's just 2 hours is a long time just to sit. So on to events. Well, an event could be a birthday, it could be a wedding, but not in relativity. We don't have to have such special events. An event could be just kind of something kind of mundane, like me putting the laser pointer down or something like that. We define an event typically in terms of just where it happened relative to a frame and when it happened. But just in terms of notation, event number one occurs at position x1 relative to s, position x1 prime relative to frame s prime. In Galilean relativity, there's no distinction between the times as measured in the two frames, so both these events occur at the same, or this event occurs at the same time relative to both frames. Event number two has position x2, x2 prime. And we talk about the spatial separation between the events, x2 minus x1, or in the other frame, x2 prime minus x1 prime. You might wonder, why not call it displacement? I usually think of displacement as an object moving, but we might have two events that are completely unconnected. We might not be talking about a particular object moving. You might say, why not call it distance? Well, distance is a scalar. We usually think of distance as a positive number. Scalar separation here could conceivably be negative. So spatial separation is a better unique phrase. And similarly here for temporal separation, it could be negative. Time interval often you would think of as just a positive thing. So here are the spatial and temporal separations. The transformation equation that we had for position can be used for each event. So there it is for event two, there it is for event one. If we subtract, we get here x2 minus x1, x2 prime minus x1 prime, and the difference in the times. Well, that's just delta x. This one's delta x prime, that's delta t. So this equation that we had for position in terms of a transformation, we can just write it as well in terms of changes in position relative for the two events. So we're back to the bus again. We had the first event, which was the woman standing up. 1 second later, a man sitting 2 meters in front of her coughs. What's the distance, or correctly, what's the spatial separation between these two events relative to frame S? So again, a question like this forces students to start thinking, okay, they could do it in their heads, but I would want to see something written down about the frames and so on. So here's the origin of frame S prime, the rear of the bus, there's frame S prime, there's event one, the woman standing up, there's the position x1 prime, 5 meters of that event. And here's event two, here's this person 2 meters in front of the woman, so that person's position x2 prime is 7 meters. There's the origin of frame S prime still at the back of the bus. And we're asked, what's the distance across here? So we can use this transformation for delta x. It's delta x prime plus v delta t. We know all the numbers and toss them in 27 meters. And again, something that students could do in their head, but now they're having to think about it in a more formal way. So we talked about Galilean relativity in terms of transformation equations, talked about events, spatial and temporal separations, and now on to a relativity principle. Galilean relativity principle says the laws of mechanics are the same in all inertial reference frames. Not all the laws of physics, just mechanics. I want to give just a quick example of one thing that means. Suppose there's a one-dimensional collision with two objects in which linear momentum is conserved relative to frame S. So relative to frame S, there's the total momentum before the collision, there's the total momentum after the collision for these two objects. I want to transform now to see what the situation is relative to frame S prime. There's the transformation equation for velocity, and I can apply that to u1, u2, u3, u4. So for example, for u1, I can substitute that's u1 prime plus v, just using that general form. And so there's u1, u2, u3, u4. Multiplying through with the m1s and m2s, this gives us all that. And now I've got an m1v on this side, and an m1v on that side. I can subtract them off from each side. An m2v, and an m2v, I can subtract them off, and I get, lo and behold, total momentum of the system relative to frame S prime before the collision equals the total momentum after. So linear momentum is conserved relative to S primed as well. So that's an example of a law of mechanics being the same for this collision relative to frame S and also relative to frame S prime. So if you notice, I said I've got m1v and m1v, and I subtract m1v from both sides of the equation. I've stopped in lectures using the word cancel. I used to say, well, m1v and m1v cancel out. More and more, with changes in the high school math curriculum, I see students given an expression like a plus b all over a, say, oh, I can cancel out the a's, I get 1 plus b. Or a plus b all over a, cancel out the a's, I get b. So I don't use cancel anymore. I talk about subtracting the same thing from both sides of the equation, or adding, or multiplying both sides of the equation by the same quantity. Major difficulty in the late 1800s was that although the laws of mechanics would transform from one frame into another okay, Maxwell's equations, which essentially govern all properties in electricity and magnetism, would not transform into Maxwell's equations if you used the Galilean transformation equations. So that was a problem. It appeared then, in the late 1800s, that the laws of mechanics would be always the same in inertial reference frames, no matter which frame you looked at, but the laws of mechanics would be different in different inertial frames. And that was a source of some consternation. I mean, that seemed like an odd universe to have some laws the same in all inertial frames, but not others. People tried changing Maxwell's equations, but that didn't work if that predicted electromagnetic phenomena that you couldn't observe. The Dutch physicist Hendrik Lorentz came up with a different set of transformations that would allow Maxwell's equations and the laws of mechanics to transform into themselves in other frames. But nobody really understood why these transformations worked. It was just regarded as a mathematical trick. But we'll see Lorentz's name associated, along with Einstein's, with these transformations in a few minutes. So that was a problem in the late 1800s. Another problem has to do with the fact that from Maxwell's equations, you can determine the speed of electromagnetic radiation, or the speed of light, c. You get the simple little equation, 1 over the square root of epsilon naught times mu naught, epsilon naught the permittivity of space, mu naught the permeability. The one has to do with the electric force, the other with the magnetic force. But the speed. Speeds are measured relative to something. And the question was, well, relative to what? I imagine you all know that the answer was it was relative to the ether. These were waves, or had wave properties. Waves need a medium in which to propagate. That's how you can hear me now, right? Sound needs a medium. Water waves need water. So surely these electromagnetic waves would need a medium. And I have here a book that was written in 1898. And I want to read to you a little bit about what was believed about the ether in 1898. The title of this book is The Atomic Theory. It was written by Professor Wirtz, who was a professor in the Faculty of Sciences in Paris, and then it was translated into English. So this is what it says about the ether. Ether is not a vacuum. Also, it doesn't say this is what we think ether is. I mean, it's a definite statement. Ether is not a vacuum. It's a medium formed of a highly rarefied and elastic matter, agitated by perpetual vibrations which are transmitted from atomic matter to the ether and from the ether to atomic matter. The medium exists between all parts of the universe. Again, not we think it exists between all parts of the universe. As a transmitter of radiations, it receives and transmits to us under the form of light and heat. The radiations, that is to say the vibrations, impressed upon it by the sun and the most distant stars, and sends into space those which proceed from our solar world. So, sort of like a biblical reading. I mean, that's just, that's the word, that's the ether. That's what people believed in the late 1800s. And again, it's not surprising. People felt that if there was a wave, there had to be a medium. I don't know why sometimes when I push this, it doesn't do anything. And other times, there we go, other times it goes down a couple of slides. Well, if there's this ether, perhaps we could measure how fast we're moving relative to it. presumably the ether wouldn't move with the Earth around the Sun. And so in 1887, not too far from here, just a little bit south across Lake Erie in Cleveland, Michelson and Morley did a famous experiment, as I said, in 1887. Assuming that we're moving through the ether, there's an ether wind. That speed of light would be the speed of light relative to the ether. And so what they did was have a source of light, and it was split. Some of the light would go across the ether wind and back. The other part would go upstream or upwind and then back. And just like a boat that has a constant speed relative to the water in a river, so you can think of the ether as a river and now a boat going up and back or this way and back, the boat that goes across the stream and back takes less time for the round trip than the boat that has to go upstream and then back. And so this experiment, which had to do with the interference of these two light beams, was designed to measure what the speed of the ether wind was. And no matter how this apparatus was oriented, you know, on the tabletop, no matter what time of year they did it, they always got no result. The ether didn't seem to be moving relative to the Earth, which seemed pretty weird. That was another problem in the late 1800s. Remember, the first one was Maxwell's equations don't transform into Maxwell's equations. So along came Big Al, 1905, the centennial of this famous miraculous year. It was just last year, of course, but he wrote three wonderful papers, one of them being on the electrodynamics of moving bodies, which is special relativity. So on to Einstein's postulates. Remember, the Galilean relativity principle said the laws of mechanics are the same in all inertial frames. And Einstein says all the laws of physics are the same, including electricity and magnetism. That's basically a philosophical statement. He's saying the universe is simple. There isn't this discrepancy in connection with inertial frames, with some laws working in all inertial frames and others not. He's saying all the laws of mechanics work in all, sorry, all the laws of physics apply in all inertial frames. And then the second postulate is just a result of the first one. If Maxwell's equations, from which you can derive the speed of light, if Maxwell's equations are valid in all inertial frames, then the speed of light is valid in all inertial frames. So the speed of light in vacuum is the same in all inertial frames of reference. And it's from that statement that you can derive all the weird and wonderful things like time dilation and so on. But it's really just a consequence of this basic philosophical statement, and then it leads to this second one. So from that second postulate, it's fairly straightforward to derive, once again, those transformation equations that Lorentz had already derived. But now there was a reason for these equations to be used. People could see that, hey, these transformation equations come about because all the laws of physics are the same in all inertial frames, and then the speed of light's the same, and then these Lorentz-Einstein transformations come out automatically, and all the laws of mechanics and all the laws of electricity and magnetism transform into themselves in all inertial reference frames. And it also gives an explanation of the Michelson-Morley experiment. Remember, the light went across in one direction and across in this direction, and the light was traveling at the same speed up and back or across and back. There wasn't any ether that speed of light was relative to. The speed of light is the same in any direction. It's the explanation of the Michelson-Morley experiment. This is an interesting book that I was given as a Christmas gift just this past year, the Born-Einstein Letters. It's a collection of letters between Albert Einstein and Max Born from 1916 to 1955. And at the end of each letter is a commentary by Max Born. And I don't know when this was first published, but it was republished last year because it was 100 years since 1905 with some new introductions and so on. And I haven't read the whole thing, but I read most of it. And there's some interesting things that I learned. One is that the Michelson-Morley experiment continued to be done by other people. And as late as 1925, there was a fellow by the name of Dayton Miller who was getting, well, he was finding a non-zero speed of the ether relative to the Earth. You know, I thought it was a done deal in 1887. And Max Born visited Miller's apparatus, and he says here, I found it very shaky and unreliable. The movement of one's hand or a slight cough made the interference fringes so unstable that no readings were possible. From then on, I completely lost faith in Miller's results. So this is 1925, 26. was not the case that relativity was quickly accepted, even after the 1919 eclipse experiments that I expect many of you know about. And in a commentary, one of Born's commentaries to a previous letter, Einstein had written some paper and he'd made a mistake in the paper. And Born comments here, "Now I can hear all Einstein's opponents, the anti-relativists, cry, 'What did we tell you? Einstein, too, makes mistakes. Why should we believe in his crazy theory of relativity?'" So, again, I sort of thought relativity was pretty much accepted into the 20s, but not so. So it's kind of interesting to go through this book and see commentary by someone who was there. Anyway, it's a good book, something I recommend to you. I find that students, whenever they're faced with a, you know, a textbook problem or an exam question involving high-speed motion, feel that they've got to use special relativity. They feel, you know, they've got to use time dilation and length contraction and relativistic Doppler effect if it's a second-year course or whatever. So it's worth emphasizing to students that relative to any one frame, nothing weird happens. The calculation of all the usual kinematical things are straightforward, even if you've got rapidly moving objects. So let me give you an example. But actually, first let me show you the pitfall avoidance tip. Give some students questions, some practice, in just one frame of reference. This is useful because very often in relativity questions, you kind of work through a solution in one frame and then just transform that result over into the other frame. It's that transformation that gives you the weird stuff. But as long as you're working just in one frame, nothing weird happens. So let me show you, here comes the example now. Well, the nucleus, stationary relative to Earth, emits a gamma ray that's later absorbed by a second nucleus moving away from the emitting nucleus. That's moving away at the constant speed of 0.75c relative to Earth. Of course, the gamma ray will move at the speed of light. If the nuclei are separated by 3 meters in the Earth frame when the gamma ray is emitted, how long in the Earth frame is the gamma ray in flight, and how far in the Earth frame does it travel? Everything is relative to the Earth frame. There's nothing relative to this moving nucleus. And so let me show you what this question is like. There's the nucleus at rest, gamma ray emitted at speed c. There's the moving nucleus going at 0.75c. They start off 3 meters apart. This is identical in terms of the solution to the following. There's a slow car moving down a highway. There's a faster car coming up behind. There's the distance separating them. How long does it take a fast car to catch up to the slow one? And how far did the fast car have to move to catch up to the slow one? It's identical in terms of the solution. There's nothing weird at all. So again, it's good to give students some practice because in my experience is as soon as they see rapid, you know, high-speed motion, they're like, whoops, time dilation, length contraction, got to use that. That's not necessarily the case. And unless they get practice with questions like this, then they're automatically going to think of the weird and wonderful stuff. We'll get to that, but students need practice with the simple things too. On to Lorentz-Einstein transformations. I mentioned that these are fairly easily derivable. They tend not to show up in high school books, which I think is a pity. I think you'll see why. Time dilation, we'll see, just a very special case of the more general transformation. Here's the Galilean transformations that we had. Delta x is delta x prime plus v delta t, or turning it around, solving for delta x prime gives that. And I've explicitly written out here delta t equals delta t prime. Just starting with the constant c of the speed of light, and the fact that one frame moves at a constant velocity v relative to the other, you can derive, with just simple algebra, these Galileo or these Lorentz-Einstein transformations. So this first one is very similar to what we had up here, except there's this gamma in front. Gamma is 1 over the root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, where v is the constant relative speed of the two frames. Here's the corresponding transformation for delta x prime, again, a gamma in front. And of course, the thing is that it's very different now. Delta t no longer equals delta t prime. Delta t depends on delta t prime and delta x prime. There's a mix of the spatial and temporal separation in one frame that goes into just the temporal separation in the other. And there's the corresponding one for delta t prime. Why don't we notice this transfer, why, you know, why weren't these transformations noticeable sort of 200 years ago? The answer is gamma is very small unless you're moving very fast or unless one frame is moving very fast. So here's gamma is a function of V over C. So V is 2/10 the speed of light. Gamma is still pretty small, only 1.02, a 2% effect. If it's 0.5, it's only a 15% effect, 1.15. 0.9, it's now starting to get appreciable, a 229% effect. And we're about to get into the good stuff, time dilation and so on. I mean, we don't teach that in elementary school. I mean, elementary school kids have enough problems with just kind of what we would call straightforward science. And I mention that because here are some things from fifth and sixth graders in St. Louis, Missouri. Vacuums are nothings. So we only mention them to let them know we know they're there. I'm not sure how clouds get formed, but the clouds know how to do it. That's the important thing. You can listen to thunder after lightning and tell how close you got to getting hit. If you don't hear it, you got hit, so never mind. And this last one's my favorite. Some people can tell what time it is by looking at the sun, but I've never been able to make out the numbers. I picture some kids going blind, you know, you know, looking for the hands and the numbers. On to relativity of time. And I think I figured this thing out. It's wireless. I think this is just too far away from the receiving unit on the laptop. Donkin experiments. For relativity of time, I start with a Donkin experiment. I'm not going to do any today. There are other things I sort of want to get to, but I find them very useful because you can start with the simple premise that the speed of light is constant no matter which frame you look at. And there's a standard Donkin experiment about a light clock. The light goes tick tock, tick tock. And then if that's in my frame and I'm moving relative to you guys, it goes a bigger distance, tick tock, and so the time interval in your frame must be bigger. And it's, anyway, those are good things to do because you can see the relativity of time very quickly. But I just mentioned it, so I'm not going to do any, but they're worth doing. I certainly do them. Relativity of time. Suppose that you measure relative to frame S the spatial and temporal separations between two events, delta X and delta T. And then the question I ask is, relative to the other frame, S prime, where the temporal separation is delta T prime, will delta T prime be larger, smaller, or equal to delta T? And the answer is, unless you know the numbers, it could be anything. There's the transformation that gives you delta T prime. It's gamma times delta T minus V delta X over C squared. Depending on the numerical values of gamma, delta T, V, and delta X, delta T prime could be bigger, smaller, or equal to delta T. There's no general connection. It just depends on the, just depends on those numbers. And I mean, I know you've all heard about time dilation, which is a simple connection between the time intervals. What about time dilation? That's a special case. And I guess it's important to emphasize that. That'll be a pitfall avoidance tip in a minute. So time dilation. Notice what just happened to the clocks up there. Stretched out, dilated. Suppose two events occur at the same position, emphasize, relative to S, and the temporal separation relative to S is delta T. If they're at the same position relative to S, that means there's been zero spatial separation. And so I can calculate delta T prime from that transformation, but delta X is zero. So I get a simple situation where delta T prime, the temporal separation relative to the other frame, which is gamma times delta T. Remember, gamma is bigger than one, so it's bigger than delta T. But it doesn't matter in which frame the two events occur at the same position. Suppose you've got two events that occur at the same position, not relative to S, but now relative to S prime. Temporal separation relative to S prime is delta T prime. Now what we're going to get is delta T. It's delta X primed now that's zero. So delta T equals this thing, delta X primed is zero. Delta T equals gamma delta T prime, which is bigger. Say that again. Delta T equals gamma times delta T prime. That's bigger than delta T prime. So if you've got two events that occur at the same position in one frame or the other, then in the other frame, the corresponding time interval, delta T prime here, delta T here, is bigger than the time interval in that frame in which the events occurred at the same position. That's time dilation. That's a simple connection between time intervals. So there's sort of a summary. When you've got two events that occur at the same position, if you represent the time interval in that frame as delta t 0, subscript 0 for zero spatial separation, the time interval between those two events relative to any other frame is going to be bigger than delta t 0 by the factor gamma. Remember, gamma is the 1 over root 1 minus v squared over c squared, v being the relative speed of the two frames. And I always find that easy to remember. Two position time, that's the time as measured in the other frame where the events occur at two different positions, is bigger than one position time. So there's two position time, it's gamma times one position time. Two is bigger than one, two position time is bigger than one position time. That's an easy thing to remember. But you can only use that if you've got one position time in one of the frames. That is, if the events occur at the same position in one frame or the other. So here's a useful style. I think I just skipped another one there. So pitfall avoidance tips. Emphasize that time dilation is a special case. And secondly, there's a very common phrase in a number of books that moving clocks run slow. That's so, what? So narrow and so special case, I would never use that. I could pose all sorts of situations in which the pit is very deep into which a person can fall if you use that. Here's a useful style of question. It doesn't involve any mathematics. In which of the following situations is the time interval between the two events as measured relative to one frame equal to gamma multiplied by the time interval measured relative to the other frame? In other words, I've only got A here, but you can imagine A, B, C, you could make up others. Is this a situation in which the two events occur at the same position in one frame or the other? If so, then you can say one time interval of gamma times the other. And if not, you can't say that. So we've got a high energy electron is emitted by a distant star, which is moving away from Earth. If the electron is moving towards Earth and is finally detected at Earth, that's event number two. Well, I'll be the star, I'm gonna emit the electron. So there's Earth, I'm the star. Here's the emission of the electron. The electron's now going that way. So we have to think about where did event number one occur? It occurred here at x prime equals zero. It occurred relative to that frame at some positive value of x. But now this frame continues to move, the electron goes on and bang, it gets detected at Earth. So relative to me, that second event occurred at some big value of negative x prime, negative 10 meters, say. And it occurred relative to that frame at x equals zero. So in this frame, first event was at x prime equals zero, second event at some negative value. Relative to that frame, the first event occurred at some positive value of x, second event at x equals zero. Time dilation doesn't apply to that situation. It's not a situation in which both events occurred at the same position in either frame. So again, I mean, you might sort of wonder, you know, why would you talk about such situations? Why not just do simple time dilation? And the answer to that question is, student, excuse me, sir, excuse me, ma'am, what if you had a high energy electron? Right, the students can come up with all sorts of interesting scenarios. And, well, I guess the teachers need to be prepared, but the students as well, I think it's useful for them to know that time dilation is just a special case, because they can come up with all kinds of other scenarios for which time dilation is not appropriate. One situation I always like to describe in an introductory course, which is a good example of time dilation, has to do with muons. Cosmic rays from deep space rain down upon our atmosphere. They collide with atoms and nuclei in the upper atmosphere. We get a spray of other particles moving down toward the Earth. And one common type of particle that sprays down is the muon. So if I can find the button here. So this is, first of all, this whole drawing is relative to frame S, the Earth. The muon is frame S prime. It gets created up there. And let's look at a typical muon. It's going to be traveling very fast. 99.5% of the speed of light gives us a nice, easy factor of gamma to work with. So the muon is created up there. And let me maybe go to the frames. Muon is frame S prime. So there's the muon. It's created at X prime equals zero. Comes down here to the surface of the Earth where it decays. It's also at X prime equals zero. the creation and the decay occur at the same one position relative to the muon. So that's one position time. Relative to the Earth, the creation was way up in the atmosphere. The decay was down close to the surface of the Earth. That's two positions. So that's two position time. So the time interval is measured in the Earth frame between the creation and the decay is going to be gamma times the time interval in the muon. And relative to the muon frame, the muon's at rest. Muons typically live for 2 microseconds. And relative to the Earth frame, it's 20 microseconds. And this solved a puzzle. The puzzle being, if muons live for only 2 microseconds, so that would be a slow-moving muon, say, in a laboratory experiment, how would it be possible for a muon to travel typically the 6-kilometer distance from the top of the atmosphere down to the bottom? And the answer is they're moving so fast that relative to the Earth, it's not 2 microseconds. They live 20 microseconds. And this just reminded me to make a comment about the sorts of questions that students might be asked in a course. Questions about high-speed subatomic particles versus questions about things more hypothetical, like high-speed spaceships and high-speed trains and sticks flying through space and so on. Questions about high-speed particles, that's about real physics, observable phenomena. Whereas questions about, I mean, I ask questions about high-speed spaceships and sticks and so on as well. But very often I'll get students say, the hand goes up, this is all just a theory, right? It's not real. Well, it is real. And Damien, I think you're giving a talk tomorrow, Saturday, about the fact that GPS, global positioning systems, in order to be very accurate, have to take into account relativistic effects for the satellites, which are moving very rapidly around the Earth. It's a practical application of relativity. So it's important, I think, not to present all of this with just hypothetical things. If a stick is flying through space at an angle, is it going to go through this doorway halfway between the Earth and the Moon? Those sorts of things. 3 months ago, I was asked by Cambridge University Press to give a pre-publication review of a textbook that had been written by a professor in a name brand American university. So the company, Cambridge University Press, sent me 3 chapters to review, one of them being on relativistic kinematics. And in that whole chapter, which was 50 pages long, with all sorts of questions, all of the questions had to do with things like high-speed spaceships and sticks flying through space. There wasn't one question about what I would call real physics, high-speed subatomic particles, for example. It was kind of bizarre, actually, not to see any reference to, again, what I consider to be real physics instead of all this hypothetical space travel kind of thing. So I just think it's important. Well, I certainly have a mix of questions, as I said, but I just think it's a huge mistake just to not talk about high-speed particles. On to relativity of length, which causes much less difficulty for students. If an object at rest has a rest length L0, then when it's moving, it has a length L0 over gamma. Gamma is its usual factor. And this length contraction occurs only in the direction of motion. And this L0 over gamma, that can be, again, derived using a Gedanken experiment. The statement that it applies only in the direction of motion can be proven or legitimized by another Gedanken experiment, but I'm just after the results. So there's a blue ruler or something, a blue rod, rest length L0, width W, but when it's moving at a speed V, you get some corresponding gamma factor, and the length then is L0 over gamma, but the width is unchanged. There's a pitfall, though, that you need to think about. Pitfall avoidance tip, number 4, I think this is. The spatial separation between two events, that's something in meters, may or may not correspond to the length of an object. Let me give an example of a question. This is a multiple choice question that you're going to do. This is quiz time. However, it's a community quiz. So I'd like you to read the question, discuss it with your neighbors. It's multiple choice. In a couple of minutes, we'll do a little show of hands. How many people think A? How many people think B and C and so on? And again, I want it to be a community effort. So, you know, chat with 3 or 4 people and get some discussion going, and we'll see what you think. You're being awfully quiet. You're supposed to be awfully noisy now. This is the quietest class I've ever had, I gotta tell you. Okay, the levels died down a little bit. Again, it's time for the vote. How many people think answer A? How many people think answer B? How many people think answer C? How many people think answer D? And answer E? Well, it was about the same as Physics 1000 last fall, actually, in terms of the responses. I'm the electron. I'm at x prime to equal zero. I'm always at x prime to equal zero. I never move relative to my reference frame. Because how far did the electron move relative to the frame of the electron? The answer is zero, which was the majority. But there were people who responded to each and every possible answer. So there are, to my way of thinking, there are three important numbers that have meters as the unit in this scenario. I'm the electron. That's about a meter. So there's the meter of beamline that I'm going to go past. So event number one is me being here. I'm the electron. Event number two is me being here. In my frame, the spatial separation has been zero for those two events. Both of those events occurred at x prime equals zero. Relative to the Earth frame, you guys, spatial separation was 1 meter. First event was at x equals zero, second event at 1 meter. And again, events are important. It's useful for students to think about events. Now, the question could have said, how are things looking relative to the electron? Relative to the electron, everything's moving that way, all of you folks, okay? So for example, Jim here starts at x prime equals zero, and now he's at x prime -1 meter, -2. All you guys are moving that way. So the beam line is rushing that way. Its length contracts by a factor gamma. The 1 meter then becomes 1 meter over gamma. That's 1/1.25, which is 0.8 meters. So that's a fairly common answer, actually, in my Physics 1000 class. People think, length contraction, 1 meter goes to 0.8 meters. But that isn't what the question asked. But it said, what length of beam line passes the electron? The answer is 0.8 meters. That's a different question. Back to the muon decay, back to what I would call real physics. This drawing, again, is relative to the Earth, and it looks kind of busy, but I've only added on one little bit relative. We had a drawing like this before. Just in the center here, I've added information about how far, relative to Earth, the muon traveled. It travels from creation down here to decay, 6 kilometers. That's because we can just say the distance traveled relative to Earth is the speed of the muon, 0.995c, convert to meters per second, times how long the muon lived relative to the Earth frame, 20 microseconds at 6 kilometers. That's how things look relative to Earth. But now let's look at how things look relative to the muon. Just as with the electron, the muon isn't moving in its own frame. So this is now relative to the muon frame. So I've only got one spot for the muon. It's not moving. What's moving is the Earth and the Earth's atmosphere moving upwards relative to the muon with this speed, 0.995c gamma is 10. The atmosphere is an object. As it rushes past the muon, we get length contraction of the atmosphere relative to the muon, length contraction by a factor of gamma. So you see I've got a much shorter length here now. It's not 6 kilometers. it's 6 kilometers L naught over gamma, only 0.6 kilometers. The muon, remember, is born in the upper atmosphere, decays in the lower atmosphere. It's got to get from up high to down low. But relative to the muon frame, it only lives for 2 microseconds. So how does it make it all the way down to the bottom? The answer is it only has to travel 0.6 kilometers relative to the muon frame. The physical fact is, again, the muon starts up there, ends up way down there. Relative to the muon, it only lives for a short time, but it doesn't have to travel very far, or that is, not much of the atmosphere has to travel past it. Relative to the Earth, the muon lives 10 times longer and 10 times faster, or 10 times farther, yes. Did I say that? Just now? Okay, thank you. Yep, it is tricky. And the muon's not moving, the atmosphere is moving. The atmosphere is moving up. So, I mean, that's a really nice example of how time dilation and length contraction work and how tricky things are. On to this final bit. What does E equals mc squared mean? Sometimes I hear statements and read statements that are a little bit incorrect. I mean, not as incorrect as moving clocks run slow, but nonetheless incorrect. What does it mean? Well, you know, Einstein used A and used B, but didn't like it, so I'd use C instead. But that's not really the answer. If you've got an object at rest, it has energy, a rest energy, just as it has a mass, a rest mass. And E equals mc squared says that the rest energy is related to the rest mass by this equation. Really what it's saying is that for an object at rest, energy and mass are just two different ways of talking about the same thing. I've got here an elastic band. It's at rest. It has a certain mass. It has a rest energy. You can calculate how big that energy would be, E equals mc squared. Now I stretch the elastic band. This band now has more energy than it had. It's got elastic potential energy. Well, E equals mc squared says it now has more mass. And if we could measure a tiny increase in mass, we would confirm, yeah, it's got more mass. There's more energy, it's got more mass. That's what E equals mc squared is all about. Rest energy and rest mass are just different sides of the same coin. They're both just different manifestations of the same fundamental property of this thing. Now you wonder, I wonder, why did I put this one up? And you can hardly, maybe you can read the word leptons. This is part of a page from the particle physics booklet. And Jim, no, no, don't bother with your glasses. What do you think about the font size there? Yeah, it's very tiny. I think they figure because the particles are tiny, the font should be tiny. You know, I usually print out things, you know, on my computer printer, I get 12 point or maybe 10 point. This must be, I don't know, 4 or something point font. I mean, this is really tiny. That's not why I showed it to you, but it's just sort of amusing. The students find it funny that the font is so small because the particles are small. There's what it really looks like. But one reason I would show students this, or one reason I'm showing this to you, is this is where leptons, so this is electron, this is muon. Muon we've been talking about, it's just a lepton. It's like an electron, just more massive. And if you look here, we've got mass m equals certain number of atomic mass units, and then the next line, mass m equals a certain number of mega electron volts. And that's the rest mass. It's expressed in mass units or energy units. Energy and mass are equivalent. You can go from one, it's basically just a unit conversion going from one to the other. And similarly for the muon, here's the mass, and here's the mass. If it's 105 MeV, this is 0.5 MeV, so it's about 210 times more massive than the electron. And you can order one of these for yourself. Go online, except this is the 2004 booklet. The 2005 booklet I checked just a couple of days ago isn't available. So maybe wait till September. They tend to send these out then. There's the web address, no www, PDG. You don't need to know this. It's the Particle Data Group. LBL is the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory.gov. So you can go online and sort of register. But wait a few months, because they weren't accepting any orders the last time I looked. So that's for an object at rest, E equals mc squared. That's a clean application of that equation. Rest energy, rest mass, same thing. What about for a moving object? Well, it still has rest energy, but it's now also got kinetic energy. So it has a total energy, which is the sum of rest energy plus kinetic energy. You can kind of turn that around and write kinetic energy in the next line as total minus rest energy. It's possible to show that the total energy is gamma times mc squared. And you can show that fairly easily with a little bit of calculus. If I mentioned to I don't actually go through the derivation in first year course, but I mentioned that that could be shown in the first year course in the fall, and some students, some physics majors came up and said, yeah, we'd like to see the derivation, so I photocopied it off. And they were so excited that it's just a page of calculus. You can work out that E equals gamma mc squared for the total energy. And gamma is this usual thing. V here is the speed of the object. So kinetic energy, up here it was E total minus mc squared, but there's E total now, gamma mc squared minus mc squared. So there's the correct relativistic expression, gamma minus 1 mc squared for kinetic energy. And that's not equal to a half mv squared unless v is very much bigger than c. If v is a lot bigger, sorry, much less than c, if v is a lot less than c, then gamma minus 1 mc squared reduces mathematically to a half mv squared. But what I really want to explore is back to this E total equals gamma mc squared. Gamma is a dimensionless number. Gamma times m is a mass. Can we call gamma times m the mass of the moving object? That is, can we just write the total energy as big mc squared, where m equals gamma times m? Where, again, little m is the rest mass, big m is perhaps this relativistic moving mass. Is that a legitimate thing to do? Well, we have to ask, what's mass? Well, mass comes in two kinds. We'll talk about them in the next couple of minutes. Inertial mass and gravitational mass. They've been shown to be equal to within one part in 10 to the 12th. But there are two separate concepts. Inertial mass, you can define it the following way. Apply a force to an object, F, measure the resulting acceleration, take the ratio of force over the acceleration, that's the inertial mass, the mass that comes into Newton's second law of motion. Now, suppose you've got a high-speed object that's moving to the right with speed v, and you apply a force in the same direction as the velocity. You can go through again, it's a fairly simple little calculation. You can work out the ratio of force over acceleration, turns out to be not gamma times m, but gamma cubed times m. However, if you apply the force perpendicular to the velocity, it turns out the ratio of force over acceleration is gamma times m. In other words, the ratio of F over A for a high-speed object is not some unique number. It's not some unique quantity. So there's no unique high-speed inertial mass that we can write down. Remember, we're trying to establish, can we write gamma times little m as the mass of a moving object? And it's saying, no, we can't. And in fact, in general, for a high-speed object, the force and the acceleration are not even parallel vectors, unlike low-speed objects. What about gravitational mass? This is no longer the mass that comes into Newton's second law. It's the mass that comes into, for a low-speed object, Newton's law of gravitation. For high-speed objects, you need general relativity. I'm certainly no expert in that, but at the University of Guelph, we have a professor, Eric Poisson, who is an expert in general relativity. He's an associate member of the Perimeter Institute, so I confer with him anytime we need general relativity, or anytime I need it. And he says, well, in general, it's difficult to define a relativistic gravitational mass. So whether we talk about inertial mass or gravitational mass, there's no unique expression that we can write down for the mass of a high-speed object. The only mass that you can legitimately talk about for an object is its rest mass. And, well, that's just useful to know, because I've seen, say, various books and heard various people talk about a relativistic moving mass, but you cannot define that uniquely. And I think maybe we should go back and talk with Albert again. He wrote a letter in German in 1948 that said the following. It's not good to introduce the concept of a mass, big M, equals gamma times M, basically, of a moving body for which no clear definition can be given. That's what I've been trying to say the last couple of minutes. It's better to introduce no other mass concept than the rest mass, little m. Instead of introducing big M, it's better to mention instead the relativistic expressions that connect together momentum and energy. And so I thought I should show you that expression. total energy squared equals momentum squared c squared plus mc squared squared. Relativistic momentum is gamma times mv. Again, little m is the rest mass. And one nice thing about that equation is it works for objects that have rest mass, but it also works for photons that have no rest mass. So if little m is zero, you get E total squared equals P squared C squared, or E total equals PC. There's an expression for the energy of a photon. I expect many of you have seen that before. Energy equals PC. We also know the momentum of a photon is H over lambda, or H times frequency over C, and we get this, these other variants for the expression for the total energy of a photon. So in summary, I've had a number of pitfall avoidance tips. Students need a good introduction in Galilean relativity, I believe. There should be questions asked about positions, velocity, and times relative to only one frame of reference, because very often you don't need the weird results of special relativity. Time dilation is a special case. Moving clocks run slow is very bad. Spatial separation might not correspond to an object's length. And it's always good, I think, to follow Einstein's advice about mass that we just saw. And one final, I guess, a couple of references. I was very lucky the first time I taught special relativity. It was at the second year level, and we used the book by Tony French, A.P. French from MIT. He has a number of books in this MIT series, paperback, very inexpensive. And I guess it was when relativity first came into the Ontario High School curriculum. I did a lot of teachers' workshops on relativity, and someone suggested that I write up the notes in a book. And so there's this little book that contains a number of the things that I've talked about today available as well. So a couple of references you might be interested in. Thanks very much for your attention.